In progress.
To the members of the media who may be on the platform. Today we are meeting with the Parliamentary Budget Office PBO making their comment on the second special appropriations bill. Just to recap, the second special appropriation bill, it's the government's intervention to deal with COVID-19 impact and the July unrest in KZN and Gauteng. So we have also invited the PBO to come and share their comments and their take on the bill. Honourable members, you are all welcome. Darren, do you have any apologies?
Yes, Chairperson, we have three apologies for today's meeting. It's from Ms. Dikgale, Ms. Lonyane, and Ms. Implant.
Okay. Okay, let's note those apologies. Any other apology? Just a second. There's also an apology coming from Honorable Nkwankwa. He won't be able to join us due to another engagement. We'll note those apologies.
Sorry, Chair.
Oh.
No, I was saying I'm on the line, but I won't be able to finish the meeting.
Oh, okay. Thank you. We'll note that, Honorable Frank. How are you?
Very well, at you, my Chair.
I'm good, thank you. So the your apologies is noted, Honorable Kwankwa. I take it that Dr. Shantis is on the platform with the team. You are all welcome, PBO team. We'll give to you to take us through the your presentation. Okay, Dr. Chances.
Thank you so much. Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members. Good morning,
Masige, colleagues. Must have a break. You'll be an any look.
Well, I'm trying to make sure that I maintain, Chair. I haven't changed. Okay. But thank you so much. And I also got excited this morning when I get the news that Bafana Bafana has won.
Yeah.
So thanks for reminding us that Zambisa. Thank you so much, Chair. Good morning, Chairperson. I'm with the platform, on the platform with the PBO team. And we really thank you the opportunity the committee has given us to brief you in this regard. We really appreciate that. I'll take on the slide on. But I think I might have a bit of a network challenges. If it does happen, I'll switch off my video. But do let me know if there are any issues. I'm just going to put on the slide to share with the members. Share. All right. Can we all see the slides, Chairperson?
Yes, we can. Thank you. Proceed.
All right. Thank you so much. I'll move right away. All right, thank you so much. This is our outline, the presentation outline. The members have seen it. We sent it through last week. Thank you. And then I think I'll just get on to the introduction. I think the bill really, the aim of the presentation, as the chair has outlined, is really to address address some of the impact that the recent events July, you know, but also taking into account some of the COVID-19 issues. It also provides an additional agent and funding allocations. I'm trying to make sure that I'm okay. Funding allocations 2000, the current financial year for those other government functions which are going to be playing a role in addressing some of these concerns. It also looks at some of the funds that have already been allocated in terms of the Section 16 of PCMA. I think, Jay, what we're trying to do, and members, we're trying to really focus on, you know, like giving a better background in terms of where we come from, where we are in terms of the looking at the fiscal government's fiscal policy framework and some of the risks that we've highlighted before, but also provide more information in terms of this special bill, how members can contribute or what members can take into account when they're in the process of the bill, which the Act, the Money Bills Act, actually gives Parliament power to amend, reject, or approve the money bill like this one is. Those are some of the key issues we're going to address when we look at the national revenue and expenditure implications for some of these proposals, but also look at to strengthen the discussions to bring some of the preliminary outcomes of the last year's spending. I had last week when the committee were concerned around the underspending. It's a very important point. I think we'll also try to flag those, which also strengthen the discussions, but also looking at the how has some of the functions spent so far since the current financial year, the first quarter of the financial year, and also spend some time on the government structure. I think, Chair and honorable members, I think what we tried to do here at the beginning, we said, look, let's take a different approach a bit, but also try to look at the background, give a background on the fiscal policy framework trends, but also, you know, try to provide some information on some of the methods that could be considered, how, you know, how far we've gone in the fiscal framework and some of the risks, which provides, you know, useful information for discussion in this regard. I think when you look at the first special appropriations bill was due to unavoidable COVID-19 and related matters, so it was really in a way try to address those. Coming to this second one, Chair and members, we're saying, look, when we look at the discussion that happened over the years around the fiscal policy framework, is that members should probably ask themselves the question whether should some of this been avoidable? You know, in a way that we're saying whether the special approach may have been avoided if government has reassessed the fiscal policy framework stance, as we have commented last year, but also whether it would have allowed government, you know, reassessing the fiscal framework stance would have allowed government to really take into account the warning about the fragile social fabric and the impact the COVID-19 has and in that reassessment. In a way, rather than extend the fiscal framework, would have allowed government to provide more continued relief to poor households and who are suffering both before, suffering even before the pandemic and facing greater hardship during the current year and the past financial year. The question is whether the devastating effect of adequate social security on the social structure, private properties, business, the economy and political stability caused by the events in July 2021 may have been avoided if social relief had been extended, had fiscal consolidation not caused government to self-limit expenditure on social security and issues of economic development at regard. Lessons, I think one of the points we bring here is that we feel that lessons from other government responses who said that they would do all that it takes to deal with socioeconomic impact who comes with the pandemic are still to be fully taken into account in our thinking around fiscal policy framework, as we have noted in the past years. Okay, my slide is moving very slow. I don't know why. Okay, let's move. Okay. Yes, several years of fiscal consolidation have had cumulative negative impact on the employment, on the economy, investment, and largely, as we've noted before, the policy choice imposed, the fiscal policy consolidation policy choice imposes self-limiting on self-limitation on governments' ability to develop long-term and sustainable and justify just solutions to the key socio-economic problems in a country and achieving some of the socio-economic crisis of the adult constitution. That's our concern in this regard. It's also self-limiting government's choice to approach to addressing the growth-limiting structural problems in the economy. It's caused government to break social compacts that seem to have been important, that supported social stability. It has also caused government to break labor agreements and thereby breaking trust within the discussion bargaining in this regard. Overall, the fiscal stance has seemed to have increased social and political stability over the years in this regard. I think we've seen over the years, Chair, that we've raised some warnings and questions in this regard that the risks faced by South African society that has to be taken into account within the fiscal policy framework, planning, budget allocations, and government long-term thinking around spending in this regard. The fragility of social fabric due to the worsening quality of life, the suffering related to extreme high structural unemployment, and extraordinary levels of inequality. And particularly, you see that the more vulnerable society are affected more in this times where you would expect that at least government would play a more role, particularly women and youth and those who are in a very vulnerable state are often get affected. Then ongoing social and solidarity protests, Chair, across the country leads to real destruction of community infrastructure assets. The point, there's been a lot of discussion, Chair, whether the events were planned or whatever orchestrated, but I mean, the point we're raising here is that even if the events were initially orchestrated, the outcome shows us that the political and economic damage of extreme poverty and negative costs of external levels of inequality can do in this regard. To regain economic stability and rebuild the economy, the government has to provide households with more stability and assurance in the form of comprehensive social security system. The cost of instability at household level is not only a macroeconomic issue, but it was also political stability and democracy issue that has to be taken into account. Look at some of the risks that we face for around the fiscal policy framework. The policy choice really forces government to focus only on social solutions to deep structural problems in the economy. There are microeconomic supply side problems that requires limited role of government in this regard. This approach is based on really for the dichotomy of understanding the role of state and market, or at least the debate around the role of state and market in the economy, that the state should limit itself to creating conditions of private sector to take lead in the economy, particularly with regards to job creation. The approach disregards the multiple roles that gets acknowledged that's played by the state in the economy. The small example, they're providing services, employing large share of workforce, owning assets, and so many other roles that has been played. Even during the pandemic, we've seen how the role of the states look at other countries very, very seen as very critical, even the development of the vaccine as well, as well as the role of the state. Some of the issues, Chair, states also play, which always have to bring the discussions, which the private sector doesn't play around dealing with the market failures and also externalities, important gaps in the key areas of structure which government has addressed. Issues of inequality through measures to address inequality that supports social and political stability and so many other things. I think the point here, we're trying to emphasize that there are debates around the fiscal framework policy stance, but there has to also be the recognition that there has to be some concerns about some of these issues or about the role that the state plays. I think, Chair and members, I was given this context, which then I'll give Dr. Olandi to take us through with the detail, literally focusing on specifically on the bill itself. Thanks so much. Dr. Olandi, I'll move the slides for you. Thank you.
Recording stopped.
Thank you, Director, and good morning, Chairperson and Honourable Members. I will take you through the technical aspects of the second Special Appropriations Bill. including the preliminary outcomes for last year and the actuals of the first quarter in the current financial year. Next slide. So,
recording in progress.
Members, preliminary outcomes for 2020-21 shows that revenue collected in is 2.94% more than the revised estimates. The expenditure is 0.9% less than the revised estimates. And the main budget balance is 8.5% less than the revised estimates. In the first quarter of the current financial year, revenue collection is currently at 28.5% of the budget and expenditure is at 22.3% of the budget. But members, just also to note that although the 22.3% is below the national benchmark, it is also calculated in terms of the entire expenditure, including the provisional allocations. So it might even be less if you exclude the provisional allocations that must still be appropriated in the adjustments budget. In the 2021-22 main budget balance, the original main budget balance is 482 billion. And if we add the social special, the second special appropriations, it will increase to 519 billion if all other amounts are kept the same. Next slide. The preliminary outcomes for last year shows that just in terms of specific votes, it shows that the total expenditure amounted to 98.6% for all votes. 14 departments spent less than 97% in the previous financial year, and five departments have spent more than 100%. The five departments affected by the second special appropriations bill are shown in green, of which three did not spend the entire budget in the previous financial year. These unspent funds could be surrendered to the National Revenue Fund during the adjustments process, or it can also be rolled over if it has been committed. Next slide. Just in terms of the expenditure at the end of the first quarter, and just to bring it into perspective with the special appropriations bill that has been tabled, a provision of 3.9 billion additional funding has been included in the bill to provide for a required capital injection should SASRA exceed its limits. We don't know whether they are going to exceed its limits. And we also, it's not very clear whether this funding request is actually urgent, because the Treasury also indicated that it might be that they need a capital injection, and if they need it, it might only be in January, as I understood it when they presented. In terms of defence, has only spent 22.2% of the current payments in the first quarter. In terms of police, they've spent 23.7% of the current payments, including COE in the first quarter, and they are still in a process of restructuring. The availability of more information on actual expenditure might therefore assist government with making better informed decisions about the requirements for defence and police, because at this stage they are still, the expenditure is still below the notional benchmark of 25%. Amounts for social relief of distress and trade, industry and competition have already been authorised in terms of Section 16 of the PFMA. And you can also see trade and industry actually already shows an almost over expenditure on transfers. They already transferred more than the notional benchmark. Next slide. In terms of the details per vote, next slide. This is just to show where these allocations will be situated in terms of the programs as well as the economic classification. So National Treasury will allocate the 3.9 billion for Sasria under Program 4, Asset and Liability Management. And it will be, in terms of the economic classification, it will be classified as payments for financial assets. Next slide. Just a bit of more information on Sasria, a few facts that I got from an integrated report for 2020. Sasria is a public enterprise listed under Schedule 3B of the PFMA. The purpose of Sasria it is the only short-term insurer in South Africa that provides cover against special risk, such as civil commotion, commotion, public disorder, strikes, riots, and terrorism. Their mandate is to provide cover for special risk events in terms of the Sasria Act and to research and investigate coverage for any special risk that can be considered to be a national interest. In terms of the products that they offer 500 million primary cover at set rates in business insurance, material damage, business interruption, construction, and goods in transit. On request, they provide corporate customers with additional cover of up to 1 billion rand. The special risk insurance cover is only applicable within South Africa's borders on both land and water. Next slide. Members, in terms of this slide, I only show a few key performance indicators from the same report. In terms of gross written premiums, their target is 2.3 billion, and the actual for last year was 2.4 billion. Premium income from alternative distribution channels, they target 2 million. Last year, they didn't get any income from that source. In terms of gross incurred loss, they set a target of less than 46% for themselves. Last year it was less than 46, it was 41.9%. They actually target to have no fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Last year they had fruitless and wasteful of 1.47 million and their regular expenditure was 543,000 rand. In terms of ethical behavior, last year all allegations of unethical behavior were investigated and actions were taken. In terms of the audit opinion, they had an unqualified opinion without any matters of emphasis in last year's report. Just on vote 19, social development, the social development second special appropriation request will be allocated towards program 2, social assistance, meaning that it's for social grants, and 500 million will be allocated towards social security policy and administration for the upgrading of these systems. In terms of the economic classification, both of these amounts will be transferred to SASA. Next slide. Also, a bit of additional information on the social grants. National Treasury indicated that 13.2 million people will be eligible to receive the special social relief of distress grant in the second appropriations bill. 7 million of this amount will be split between 7 million caregivers. However, it is really not clear how these caregivers are defined. I went through the SASA report for the end of last year. There's no definition for caregivers in that report. And the 5.8 million beneficiaries were based on the previous grant recipient numbers. If you just look at the detail on the previous slide, on the table, you will see, members, that in terms of the total expenditure on social grants in 2020, the total expenditure amounted to 90.3%. Some of the grants were taken up, basically fully taken up, such as the child support and the old age grants, but there are some grants such as the disability foster care and then the grant in aid that hasn't been taken up fully in the previous financial year. When we look at the bottom, it really looks like if the numbers, all the numbers, that the targets that were set, those beneficiaries received the grants, but it doesn't compare with the expenditure in terms of that. Next slide. In terms of some of the challenges identified for the Social Relief of Distress Grant, SASSA actually told the Select Committee on Health and Social Services on the 1st of September that the AG findings on the 350 Special Relief Grant indicated the lack of data integration across government. I think therefore the special appropriations are requesting 500 million. To try and correct that matter. In terms of the grants being paid to individuals who are not distressed, the numbers amounted to 670,000 were paid to individuals who did not qualify. Although this number seems to be small, given the scale of relief, it still should be prevented. SASSA has referred cases of fraud and compliance for investigation. About 241 criminal cases have been opened against government employees and 657 against company directors. Next slide. Just members, in terms of defence, the special appropriation will be allocated to Program 2, Force Employment. 700 million, and in terms of the economic classification, it will be allocated to compensation of employees and goods and services. Next slide. On police, it will be allocated to Program 2, Visible Policing, and in terms of the economic classification, the entire amount of 250 million will be allocated for compensation of employees. So the last one, trade and industry, the allocation is going towards industrial financing, and this money will be transferred to public corporations and private enterprises, namely the Industrial Development Corporation. Thank you, members. I think that this was the end of my technical presentation.
Thank you, Dr. Olandi. I'm trying to multitask here, Chair. So it's excellent. Yes, no, thank you so much, Dr. Olandi, and thank you once more, Chair and members, for the opportunity. I think in closing, Chair, just want to also highlight some of the risks that, in the medium term, the fiscal framework ought to take into account going forward. I think what you're saying is that the social, economic, and political risks associated with the extraordinary high inequalities in South Africa are not the only risks facing us and the global community. Ongoing pandemic and the risks of the new pandemic as well, that just to be taken into account going forward and its impact on the economy and society. And climate change, risks related to severe weather disaster, and also prolonged droughts are not far out events, but are occurring now and have to be planned for and taken into account in our planning going forward. The impact of the fourth industrial revolution as well, also that has been taken and related understanding and issues. This is taken into account in particular, planning and budgeting for enhanced skills and foster resilience to disruption that's been brought about or seen being brought about by technology in the mainstream and some other sectors in the economy of the economy. Consideration even the public sector as well. Considerations is required for increased government expenditure on comprehensive social security. As has been discussed, debated a lot, I understand that national health insurance, improved education and training opportunities to promote solidarity across society and to ensure that the social stability there are three conditions for political and economic stability. Social and political instability can cause huge material damage in a very short period of time. Spending on stability is an investment. Preventing such damage should be seen as an investment. It should be seen as the way it's very important to take that into account. Fiscal policy response to planning for risk and uncertainty could include the enhancement of the automatic stabilizers as part of the comprehensive social security system, additional automatic stabilizers that kicks in when there is a crisis, as we've seen in the events that happened in July. A developing and growing country, like South Africa's economy, requires stability associated with building an inclusive economy, which means government's fiscal policy framework and long-term planning has to start increasing its role to ensure the social economic rights are realized as required by various government policy instruments. This is to increase taxes and awareness that to borrow more have to be seen as an investment, Chair and members, in the future, and take into account that reconstruction and development cannot happen in an unstable environment. In a context of, in conclusion, Chair and members, really what we're trying to raise here with looking back and looking at the trends of the fiscal system is really for members to take into account some of these questions and ask these questions as they consider the bill and some of the future planning fiscal policy objectives and planning going forward, how we take into account these learning and understanding and the experiences going forward. The draft second special bill proposes additional urgent funding to allocate, I think, $32 billion, as Dr. Lange noted in detail. This amount includes allocation already authorized in terms of the Section 16 of the Financial Management Act to assist members with their deliberations and consideration to approve, amend, reject second special provisions bill. The PBO provided more information in this regard. We showed you what has happened in the prior year, other areas of under collections we've seen revenue and outperforming the expected targets, but also seen areas where spending has not been in terms of what was expected, which is leaving some rooms there. The first quarter outcomes have also shown that it's a bit of a slow in spending in some of these areas, but also there's more revenue collection, as the former Minister of Finance has noted last month, that there has been better revenue collection than what anticipated. The post-special appropriations is expected to increase and the main budget balance is noted there. The primary outcome of 2021 and expenditure of the first quarter shows the underspending or slow spending. Let me say slow spending already in some of these areas. Social development estimated that approximately 30 million people will be eligible to receive SDR COVID grant, as it were, and saying there are areas that require special oversight in considering such requirement. Chairperson, I think that's where we want to stop. This is our comment, and we thank you so much and members for the opportunity in this regard. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Sanchez. Thank you, Dr. Olani, and the team. Oral members, you know how we do it. Can I get indications of the oral members would like to interact with the presentation.
Matafa.
Okay, Matafa. Matafa.
Peter.
Mulenzana.
Peter.
Matafa. Peter. Lenzana.
Sir Rupin, please.
Rabul Sarupen.
Kaiso.
Rabul Kaiso. Okay, is that all? Okay, thank you. Let's start, Honorable Matafa.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning to you, Chair, and Honorable Members, Team TBO. Chair, if you may allow me, I request to keep my video off due to an unstable network connection, if I can do so. I just have four points coupled with questions that I need to make. But before I do that, let me welcome the presentation and thank Dr. Hollandi and Janchis and the PBO team for the same work that they have done. The presentation is actually helping us go forward in this discussion. The first one, Chair, is just a direct question. And because of the sentiments that I pick up from the presentation when the PBO speaks to the fiscal consolidation stance, we are correct to say that PBO feels a concern.
Just a second, Honourable Matafa. Honourable members, and can you please mute? Okay. Honourable Matafa, please come.
Thank you, Chair. No, I'm saying, Chair, the first point that I would like to make is that from the sentiments that I pick up on the fiscal consolidation stance that I carried in the presentation, is that the PBO has a view that a continued fiscal consolidation stance will exacerbate the challenge that we face of unemployment, inequality, and poverty. I just want to be taken across the bridge as far as that is concerned, if that is the view. The second point, Chair, is that the PBO seems to be advocating for a more comprehensive social security system in its presentation. Now, we all know that there is strong consensus around the matter, but of late, the reaction to and subsequent withdrawal of the Social Development Green Paper on Comprehensive Social Security and Retirement Reform may be an indication that some funding arrangements of the envisaged security system might remain a contentious issue for some time to come. What is the PBO's take on this? How can we ensure that all stakeholders and role players are one, firstly, on the consensus that a comprehensive social security system is required, and we are also aligned as far as the funding arrangements are concerned. The third point, Chair, is on the same issue of the comprehensive social security system. Now, the PBO takes the discussion further and emphasizes the need for a national health insurance or the rollout thereof. Now, my question, Chair, is that given the current circumstances where the country finds itself, will the rollout of NHI be affordable since we have experienced unplanned spending pressures, obviously, firstly, induced by the unexpected COVID-19 pandemic, and secondly, the unrest that have just plagued the country, particularly affecting Gauteng and KZN. Other challenges that are related to our position as a country are the depleting state coffers due to a slow economic growth. And obviously the NHI, in my view, will deal with other constitutional obligations that need to be adhered or complied with. Will this be an affordable and a possible plan to roll out, given all this host of issues that I'm raising? And the last one, Chair, and this is a matter that is very close to my heart, of small businesses. We speak of an allocation specifically to assist those small businesses. I think we're speaking of 1.3 billion. That is aimed at assisting those businesses that were hit by the unrest. Now, I once learned, Chair, that there is no best teacher like experience. The experience after the pandemic is that government tried to intervene to assist businesses that were affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. And my main focus will be on the 200 billion guaranteed loan scheme, which underperformed dismally. And in that space, Chair, we have different responses or reasons as to why it underperformed. The one side would say, no, there was no uptake from the market. But when we are in the market, because we service constituencies says, look, Member of Parliament, if you applied as a black business for this guaranteed loan scheme, you will be lucky to be declined. And I asked, but why do you say lucky to be declined? They said, no, majority of us were simply ignored. There was no response in order to say, yes, you have pledged your application, but your application is declined due to the following. Even when government has put its neck on the block to say that we will guarantee the majority of the loan that you will give to small businesses, the majority of black businesses did not benefit. And that fund or scheme ended up underperforming. Now, with this experience, Chair, the question is, from this allocation that you are making, does PPO have a view that the government has enough mechanisms in place to ensure that this particular intervention succeeds? And secondly, it has the desired outcome, particularly as it relates to assisting small businesses in these two provinces in particular that were affected by the unrest. And lastly, would PBO maybe suggest conditions that can be attached to this particular allocation? And if yes, what kind of conditions? But those conditions, if they are going to be listed, how will they then assist that those particular businesses that are affected are assisted? I love soccer, Chair, and there's one soccer player in Soweto whose shop was severely affected by this unrest. And I'm trying to follow him to see how is he going to be assisted, particularly by our government, in ensuring that he comes back from that ashes of the unrest and become a profitable business like he was before the unrest. I will pause there, Chair. Thank you very much for the opportunity to participate. And once again, thank you for a good presentation.
Thank you, Honorable Matafa. Honorable Peters, can you please come in?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And may I request that I switch off the video?
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks to Dr. Janke and team for the presentation. Although in some instances I lost a bit of network, you know the challenges in these parliamentary villages. And Chairperson, I've got one question or two. I just want to know from the PBO whether there is any particular aspect of the special appropriations bill that the PBO suggests or thinks should be reconsidered or amended. Secondly, in your view as the PBO, what sanctions should government impose against companies which attempted to defraud the system by double dipping and fabricating financial loss and damages in order to benefit from the allocation of the special appropriations bill? And Chairperson, is the PBO able to help us as those committee with an analysis of the state of SOEs and whether the fiscals will be able to carry any request for anticipated bailouts? Which of the SOEs show red flags and what needs to be done by Parliament to slow down the slippery slope they seem to be going under? Lastly, Chairperson, it is with regards to the departments that underspend, I just want to find out from the PBO whether underspending is a good thing under the prevailing economic situation or conditions. And also in reverse, I would want to know whether overspending is an indication of the pressures that the particular entity or department is having. I'm raising this question because a Chairperson, you'd remember, I would mention the entity that came to us that deliberately went ahead and filled positions which were not funded and came to the committee to indicate that they had a shortfall and they needed those particular positions. And when on investigation, we realized that the positions had been vacant for many years. And for that particular entity in that particular year to take that decision was for me an indication that the entity failed to plan. So I just want to hear from CBO, what is your views on this underspending and overspending?
Thank you, Honorable Peters. Honorable Denzana, it's your turn.
Good morning, Chairperson and colleagues. Good morning, Dr. Sanchez and Tim. Chairperson, let me also follow suit. I just wanted to show face, and after which I would then ask that I switch off the video.
By all means, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson. Chair, even with me, with a few questions. One, I think it's slides 10 and 11, Chairperson. You know my passion, Chairperson. It will always be looking at the impact of whatever that we are doing, particularly when you are talking either budget cuts or transfers. Now, Dr. Jadis and Tim, are you saying to us through those two slides where you project some element of understanding and all, that at least the transfers that have been done are justifiable? That's one question. But then also in the same vein, Chairperson, one would like to know that if there is this perpetual transfer of the budget from the entity, the departments which have understand, what is the impact to the end user where the budget was actually meant to go and deliver down there when we are happily transferring just because you have got these entities and departments which are understanding? That is one part. Then the second one would be, there was a slide Dr. Orlando was talking to relating to allocation to police. And in that slide, she merely referred to compensation of employees, if I can put it. But now my interest is, looking at the manner in which police are dying on line of duty, just over the recent days, we were watching the annual ceremony where the president was laying wreaths relating to such. And it was very painful, Chair. But now my question would be, besides focusing on incentivizing the work that police are doing, what is it that the budget office could advise in terms of your, how can I put it, the tools of trade, Chairperson? Are we having enough tools of trade for police such that we can then be comfortable? Then the last one, Chair, would be, I didn't get Dr. Chante's presentation well when it comes to our contingency reserve. Are you happy with our contingency reserve? Have we not exhausted it through this appropriation? Or are you saying it still can carry us through because the year is still early, the year is still young? Thanks, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Lenzana. Honorable Sarupen, please come in.
Thank you very much, Chair. And for some of the reasons, my colleagues, my network is on 3G, so I won't turn my video on, and my apologies for that. Chair, with regards to the presentation from the PBO, I think that obviously the warnings around potential for social unrest across South Africa because of inequality isn't something unique to the PBO. It's been suggested and spoken about for a very long time, and we've seen lots of potential sparks that could lead to more unrest by all sorts of different things, not just in the political space, but in many other spheres. But the key thing is that the PBO makes recommendations around a lot of fiscal policy changes that they believe need to be made without giving us concomitant changes to broader economic policy. And I realize the mandate is to just look at the budget. But these things don't happen in a vacuum. You have constrained fiscal space because of economic policy decisions. And so it's quite important that you make sure that you make economic policy decisions that can support fiscal objectives over time. So if you want to expand Social Security, you've then got to you've got to generate more revenue. And what's lacking from the PBO's presentation is what economic policy changes need to be made. That's the first point, Jen. I'd like to get a sense from the PBO as to what macroeconomic policy changes they'd like to make in terms of trade, in terms of energy regulation, et cetera, or any sector for that matter, and what those changes would look like to support the growth to have a more accommodative fiscal policy stance. And then in terms of monetary policy, I want to get a sense from the PBO because in the past we received presentations from them where they're very critical of the overall approach of the states towards macroeconomic stability. I happen to think that macroeconomic stability and the approach towards that through inflation targeting and other means is quite good. I think we've seen that when governments print unlimited amounts of money, you end up destroying an economy. And I'd like to understand the PBO's take on the current macroeconomic approach towards stability and why they are so critical of the approach that is currently in place in terms of monetary policy. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Sarupen. Can I ask Honorable Kaiser to come in?
Yes, thank you very much, Chair. Let me first start here, Chair. On the presentation, thank you very much for the presentation by PBO. I just want to, you know, Chair, when the doctor see that his patient or her patient does not recover well, he gives a new prescription. So I'm trying to talk to the issue on fiscal policy that in the view of the PBO, my question is rather, don't you think it's going to be necessary for a radical review of the policy in such a way that it affects necessary changes as regard to the current shaping economic challenges? I just want to go to the area where you're pointing out outrightly that the cause of the South African economic challenges are unemployment, inequality, and poverty, which has caused a persistent low economic growth as opposed to fiscal consolidation. I think also we should not forget here also that the economic challenges here are structural also in nature. So if they are structural, for instance, they point back to issues of education, health, you know, unfortunately being one of the key central areas of, you know, economic growth under these circumstances. So don't you think the PBO that it is necessary that we boost in the long run those two areas? I want to agree with my colleague on the national health insurance, and secondly on the issue of education, because the president has talked and touched about the issue of education and skills that is required. So now, but then if we give the same medication, old medication, things may not change necessarily. So they would need a surgical, they must undergo a radical shift such that it accommodates this prevailing circumstance which come and go, like the crisis of COVID-19 and other disastrous situations that the country finds itself in. So, but then they need a long-term planning in terms of policy to accommodate these emergent situations. And now I want to go to the area which was raised earlier on the over-collection of revenue and slow spending and underspending. Looking at that developing situation, let me rather refer to the issue of underspending. It has been perpetually been reported quarter after quarter when we meet, but it seemingly it is something that is going to, a trend that is going to continue like that. Don't you think perhaps there is a loophole in the Money Bills and Related Matters Act that perhaps we need to be looked at, such that people find it very difficult, to be doing underspending, and low spending? Isn't that perhaps there a loophole when you look at the Money Bills and Related Matters Act that perhaps we need to amend or do something about it? I just want to get an opinion from the PBO's view around that particular issue. Now, I don't know, you refer to people breaking the social compacts. Can you perhaps give an example of these compacts that we are referring to, so that perhaps one may come at a later stage? Honorable Chair, I think I'm covered with the rest of questions raised by my colleague. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Raul Kaiso. Let me follow you. Start by again welcoming the presentation from PBO. Perhaps my first question will be, PBO is saying that government should have foreseen some of these things, like for instance, not stopping the SRB grant, right? Now, what are you saying about the fact that something which was not there at that time in terms of projections, where SARS, the Minister of Finance said it's because of over-collection by SARS that the government has been able to make the intervention that it's making through this second special appropriation bill. What is it? Because what I was exactly saying, as far as it is concerned, because nobody knew at that time that SARS would over-collect because of the overperformance of the mining sector. So when the budget was presented, how did it be foreseen? Just want to hear. I'm sure there's a line of thinking that you are coming up with there. The government intervention, for instance, in terms of trying to deal with the inequality, unemployment, and poverty. But let me talk to inequality and poverty. Over 45% of the budget is spent on education, health, social development. Are you saying that is not enough? If that's what you are saying, then what is the benchmark that you are using? How do we compare with other countries as far as spending in those areas is concerned? Dr. Olandi, about SARS provision or the transfer, I hear in your fine print you saying that, and correct me if I'm wrong, saying that that's not necessary or may not be necessary? What do you base on that statement? What are you basing it on, this statement? Is it perhaps you see that they've got enough resources, or are you foreseeing a situation where there'll be few people who'll be making claims from SASRE? I think this is the last question for now. You seem to, again, to be saying there's a room for tax increase. Is that what you are saying? What do you think the impact of that would be on the economy, on future economic performance? You know where what I'm basing my question on? You know, there's a school of thought who says we are above the international benchmark when it comes to company in income tax. Again, when we increase VAT, VAT being a regressive tax, again, there's a lot of complaints to say that was not supposed to happen. So where is the room for tax increase? But related to that, I would also like to hear a comment on the view that you are taking to the reduction of company income tax, which was introduced during the budget time by the Minister of Finance. I think in the absence of any further questions, I'll go take it back to you, Dr. Sanchez, and please respond to the issues that have been raised. And I take the view, and I would like us to continue that one, that for questions that we are not able to answer now, we should not, I don't say that you do it. Let's not try to give convenient questions. If people want to do a bit of a research on those things and then send us a properly researched responses, we also welcome that. But please, can you deal with the questions that you can deal with? I know amongst your team, you can't deal with everything which is here, but I'm just saying that you must always know that this committee does give that leeway. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. Thank you so much, Honourable Members. Thank you so much for this opportunity. Actually, I was going to say that, Chair, that some of the questions certainly are more empirical questions, rather than just answers in the cuff. So we'll highlight those. But some of the work we've done already, we'll highlight those as well, but we'll do some further work in that regard. Certainly, we'll do that. I think, Chair, what I'll start with, really, I've got a lot of my team are here, so I'm quite happy that we'll try to deal some of these issues as much as we can. Look, I think what I've started with is that what we have seen, the government has really, government, the country, we've signed up for National Development Plan. And some of the principles really around the National Development Plan, is around embracing the evidence-based policy, from the government perspective, where government is committed to, when they propose policies, they ought to do some social impact assessment of policies. And certainly, that can go a long way. And I think one of the sentiments that we pick up from what we're trying to say, we're trying to, play in the space, look, that needs to be a part of oversight process where, not putting out a policy proposals without understanding, also debating the implications for the society, economy, and the public finances. So it's a very important point that I'm going to start my response with. And I think as a TPO, it's one area that, we have to, will be working towards trying to provide information that really assists the committees, members of parliament, in that regard, and that's what we're working towards, and I'm quite confident that we will be able to do that over the Act requires us to provide advisory command on macroeconomic policy and fiscal policy. It doesn't really, bar us from commenting on macroeconomic policy. So I heard one member saying we should focus on the budget. But nevertheless, I mean, the budget in itself, it can be seen in isolation, Chair. The members can be seen in isolation. A budget is not the means and end. You know, it's not an entry. It's a means and end. It's a means and end. And that's how we also try to emphasize the importance of the discussion seen in that light. And hence, we provide this very, very important information in our perspective, which enable the committee to have discussions around these implications on society and economy and public finance. I think the chairperson, the issue of our stance, I think what we have done over the years, we have certainly agreed that we're not going to provide recommendations on a particular policy in a way not really taking a stance, sort of taking away responsibility of members of parliament from taking decisions and policy. What we do, we provide with information and that enables you, when we're considering these proposals by government, by different stakeholders, we provided that support to you. So we're quite deliberate. We're not taking a particular stance. Because most of these things are, in any case, policy issue come political decisions in that regard. So we provide more information in that regard. Coming back to the issue around fiscal policy as well, fiscal policy framework, it's besides that to say there has to be some realization. I mean, some of these issues, some of the public finance, economics, and finance issues are really contested issues, you know. I really contest that in South African context, really contest it globally. And it's also policy choices. And that has to be recognized in that regard. But what we're trying to provide information to say, what are the likely outcomes of these policy choices? And we provide examples on what has happened. And that's what we're trying to start. So we've been discussing these issues over time to say a certain policy choice will lead to that. And it's frankly, the global discussion, I mean, during the pandemic, we've seen a lot of discussions around, what kind of fiscal policy stance would be required in immediate stances and also over the medium term. And one of the presentations was made, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago, last month, on the committee, where we've actually decided there has been, where we looked at economic development challenges that we have as a country. We talked about the issue of convergence around what government has to do globally, but also saying the importance of fiscal policy is seen as a very important tool that governments have around the world, in trying to firstly weather the storms around the immediate socio-economic needs, the economy, but also rebuilding the economy. Certainly, as fiscal policy is seen by many countries as a role, very important, has a important role to play as we're trying to design, showing the importance of the state in actually being the main role player and fiscal policy, both expenditure and revenue policy being and a very useful power or a tool that government has directly has to try to deal with some of the issues of economic development, inequality, dealing with social issues that others are more worse in South Africa than many other countries. The question around basic income grant, comprehensive support, skill support, we are actually in finalizing a brief for the one committee, I think finance committee, around the discussions of the basic income grant. I think we had committed that sometime before MTPS, we will do a discussion broadly. And we can circulate, like we do with other committees, the brief on basic income grants. We will circulate to other four committees as well, as we often do. But I think for me, Chair, the comment there is we start to say, look, the question is that whether we should do it and whether it's we can afford it and so on. It's a very relevant question that we need to have. But I think for me, how I see it is that the question should start by saying, as a society, as a country, as South Africa, are we happy with the level of inequality? Are we happy with poverty? Are we happy with how the society is? And from there, we can start saying, okay, we're not happy. Are we happy then? What instruments can be used in regards to try to do some of these issues? And of course, like Honorable Minister said as well about trying to different medications and so on. And I think if we can agree on the level of inequality we want to have, level of poverty, then it can take us quite a long way, whether what kind of level of security, social security we have. Of course, the employment and other measures are very important. But I listened to UN discussion last month, and one of the striking issues is that actually the poverty is not striking in a way of surprise, but the emphasis how it's made, the poverty is actually a human rights issue as opposed to people and economics and finance question whether to decide or not. And I think also we shouldn't see that in a way of as an expenditure. There's a very economic thought, you know, and how does it filter down to you know public finances, in and out of public finance. It's a very question that I think hopefully in our people will come up with those questions. So that's how I'll answer the question about whether we should have it. I think it's a South African question and whether it should be few people or who other players should be invited in the conversation. It's a very important question. Who else should people who are experiencing this poverty be part of the conversation and who else should be there? I think that's how I leave it there without preempting our discussion. Of course, the issue around funding is a big issue. And I think the issue around funding, it's worth also being taken into account and thinking about it quite objectively. Because when I looked at the tax expenditure without really painting anxiety there, there's probably a lot of tax expenditures which we need to really, as a society again, as a country, say, are these tax expenditures perpetuating inequality, income inequality, because they are only benefiting certain high earning or whatever the case may be, or which are some of the tax expenditures are not really making our society realize the goals, objectives that set out for, you know. So that's another area, and I think we need to think about it that way. And which other areas, because one of the tools that's used globally to deal with inequality, income inequality, is really tax instrument, and really ensuring it. And of course, the counter debate is about that there's already fewer tax base and so on. Let's have this conversation very objectively, but with a goal of agreeing first whether are we happy as a society, the level of inequality, level of poverty that we have in Scotland, particularly now with the during the time of COVID-19. I've seen very, very much people feeling like there's nothing to lose and that can take advantage of this regard. The question which also this talks about the issue of NHI funding and how much many countries have realized that there's the need for thinking over the long term. And so on. But again, I agree and accept these are policy choices. And at least in terms of the national development plan, you know, the idea around evidence-based and socioeconomic assessment that is followed by policy proposals is very useful. And we are happy to provide information in this regard. And of course, the issue of NHI as well, looked at it as a more broadly economic tool rather than just a healthcare tool. Because when you have a healthy labor force, you're able to really have more productive in that regard. But of course, I'll leave it there in that regard. The issue of SMMEs, Chair, it's an informal business. It's a very important point. And I think we also believe that there should be very considered effort in the system to try and protect informal business people and small business, which more those who are also affected in the system. The question around what we've seen over the years, I had a conversation with a colleague from GTEC. They are doing quite a very, they've done some work on the expenditure efficiency programs, which is very useful work, I think, that should also filter in trying to think about, you know, how to ensure that really there's better spending, there's better ability realized in that regard. So I'll also recommend that, you know, there should be some time where the expenditure efficiency work that's done by Treasury has been discussed in the committee. Around the issue of state-owned entities, we've done some work for where we can share the code, but I think we can do more, you know, substantive work if the committee gets a specific, you know, question, but we can also discuss it with the committee at a later stage. But I think what we have done in our work before, we just decided to say, look, let us look at some of the conversation around state-owned entities. We need to, in a way, have a sense of always distinguishing both the commercial mandate and developmental mandate, in a way try to have conversation becomes more better and see what we get from there. But I think if there's one question, Chair, which I think is a more an empirical question, than just the answer from the car. But I think some work was done over the years in this regard. And then coming back to, before I give my colleagues, there's one question I wanted to quickly respond to. It's around the issue of 45% that is spent on social spending. Look, the thing, Chairperson and members, is that we have to recognize that South Africa is one of the worst inequal societies, at least in terms of the IMF, World Bank, many interviews, and many multilateral evidence has shown that even ourselves that we're one of the highly unequal society, high poverty and so on. And if we look at it that way, if you compare it, we have to take that into account, and so on. But I think there has to be a lot of concerted effort to really create more jobs, more opportunities, which a role the state has to play a particular role in that regard. I think that I would answer the question that whether it's enough, 45%, it has to be contextual. It can't just be comparing an apple to a lemon in that regard. And certainly the issue about the economic policy, as I said at the beginning, Chairperson, our members said, we don't take a stand in particular policy stance or whatever, but I think we're drawing information. What we have said before in our work, we've really said that the economy as is, it's excluding majority of South Africans who are not participating in the mainstream economy. And economic policy that we get into has to really take that into account and also ensure that people who are not, who excluded before, or society, sector side were excluded before, has to be brought into account. We have more people participating, like to have more bigger economic growth in this regard. And I was having a chat with a colleague earlier. There are certainly some informal business which I feel they're not really accounted for in the economy in that regard. And also, what we have done in the previous report in May, which talked about the economic development, we looked at the issue around human development index. It has been in very decline, which really shows that we need to really strengthen our human development index in the particular. And also we talked about the need for really, deliberate industrialization in some of this area to ensure that we have more industries or more participation in that regard. I think another comment I was just say around that issue that is coming. I think Dr. Mohamed will come in there. The last point is on tax discussion, Chair. Before I give my colleagues, I think I'm taking too much time. But the last one is on tax revenue and areas where they could be increased and so on. I think over the recent months or years, there has been a lot of global discussions around the level of taxes. There's consensus or convergence around trying to actually stop the race to the bottom, there's a serious conversation around stop the race to the bottom, so which for me is a good start of conversation, but I think there need to be further conversation here to say we can't compare South Africa to a developed country. Developing countries frankly rely heavily on income taxes, and because they base their competitive side to the consumption tax. And when we start doing comparison, that has to come into effect as well. But also the issue, which I think colleagues from Treasury did actually acknowledge, that the issue of tax expenditures comes to fore as well, because there's a bit of distortionary in looking at the tax CIT tax rate as a 28% in itself, because in effect, the effective tax rate is far low below that, below 14% effective tax rate, which shows that we've actually given up a lot of expenditure to business, in a sense, to try to encourage investments, try to do so many things. And when you talk about higher tax rate, we should really talk about effective tax, not really the 28% in that regard. And I think, colleagues, as I understand, the reform also tries to look at in that aspect. But I think there is a broader conversation globally to try to deal with some of the loopholes in the tax system. Of course, the G7 consensus in June gave us largely the developed countries, but it's a good conversation because you start looking at tax as a more of a, at a user level, a multilateral organization, as multinational internationally, as opposed to the current system which is focusing largely on small business. So yes, there is expenditures in taxes. If you're going to increase taxes, talk about those openly, and also around the global convergence around the need to stop the race at the bottom with regards to the corporate income tax in that regard. I think I'll stop the chair. I've spoken a lot. I'll give Dr. Landi and Dr. Mohammed and another team member who will come in. Thank you so much. Dr. Landi?
Thank you, Director. I'll start with a question of Honourable Matafa on the NHI. I think we really need to discuss the policy on the current NHI further, because there are two aspects to the NHI funding and expenditure. The one side is basically to get ready to provide a national health service. And the other aspect is about the creation of a national health insurance fund. So to me, in the draft policy that was tabled in Parliament, there was a bit of confusion between the two, because in my view, I think all the NHI funding at this stage needs to be allocated towards getting ready to provide a proper health service to citizens. And so to me, if underspending on the NHI grant is actually not acceptable, because we really need to get our health system at a stage where it is of good quality. And that is what we need to basically monitor and advocate, is that basically to get the health system ready so that we can provide the service. So the National Health Insurance Fund is something different. The department actually envisaged to create an entity in terms of the creation of this fund and to manage this fund. So we also still need to get our minds around the proper implementation of the National Health Insurance. And then in terms of members, this tabling of this special appropriations bill is to for members to decide on whether this is urgent. So in some instances, I'm not totally convinced by the presentation on the information that the Treasury has, that all of these appropriations are urgent. Specifically in terms of, there was a question in terms of Sasha, Honourable Buthelezi. Not that, in my view, that it's not necessary, but the current information available is not enough to make a decision whether we should now urgently provide them with 3.9 billion rand. They still doesn't know the exact amount that they're going to need. I might be speaking under correction, but the Treasury indicated that they might only need this fund in January next year. So my only argument is this an urgent allocation that we need to approve now in a special appropriations bill? In terms of the same argument with all the preliminary outcomes of last year and the current expenditure in the first quarter. The first quarter expenditure is not enough to make a decision whether police and defense will need more money. And both of those departments, defense and police, has underspent in the previous financial year. And if we can wait until the adjustments budget process, we will have more clarity on why they're underspent and whether that underspending was committed and whether that spending will be rolled over or whether they will just give it back to the revenue fund. So basically, is this also urgent at this stage? Or should we wait until we have more information, another 3 months information, and approve additional funding if still required during the adjustments budget process? I think I've answered Honourable Melanzana on that as well. And then in terms of the, also in terms of this under and over expenditure, the committee also asked us to do a report on the 14 departments that you had hearings with that had problems with a decline in the budget. The report is, I think we will be submitting it soon. Dr. Dumisani is just finalizing it. But in some instances in that report, we compared the expenditure with performance information for the current financial year. And in many instances where departments received a declined or a reduced budget, they didn't make any changes to the targets or the outputs for this year. So they were actually not happy with the decline in the budget, but they indicated that they're still going to reach the targets. They didn't change the targets. So that report will also assist in making decisions on this special appropriations bill. Yes, I think I've spoken about the under and overspending, and I've also spoken about the oh, yes, there was a question on the contingency reserve. The contingency reserve has not been appropriated yet. So we're now going to basically borrow additional funding for this special appropriations, but there are still provisional allocations. There's a provisional allocation of 12.6 billion, for example. I think that is still from the presidential job creation fund that hasn't been appropriated. It's just provisional. So we are currently, we want to immediately now, urgently allocate funds, additional funds for 7 million caregivers. But can't we use that fund during the, or appropriate that fund during the adjustments process for that purpose? If we want to allocate additional funds for caregivers, because caregivers are also funded through the EPWP program, but now we just urgently need to make a decision to provide additional funds through the social relief of distress grant for caregivers, for example. And the contingency reserve is still there, 12 billion. It must still be appropriated during the adjustments budget. So the whole argument is, are all of these requests urgent, or is it only the authorized section 16 of authorized appropriations that are really the urgent appropriations that this committee needs to consider? Thank you, honourable members.
Dr. Mohammed, you can come in.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Yankees. Honorable Chair, with your permission. Can you hear me?
No, there's an echo. You have more than one device. There's an echo on your phone.
Is it still giving an echo? Sorry, I don't have, I've only got on my laptop. Sorry, I apologize. Thank you, honorable members. I'm going to be answering the broader economic issues, and I'd like to start with saying that the PBO has over several years now, even before COVID pandemic, been questioning the use of fiscal consultants, and basically said, and we our 2019 pre-MPBPS and our post-MPBPS both, I think, provide pretty comprehensive outlines of our views with in the pre-MPBPS with some draft and explanations to those. And so I think it may be worth sort of revisiting some of that if the members are interested. But one of the big questions that we kept asking before the COVID pandemic hit and the problems that the economy was facing, particularly with low levels of investment and the recognition that, you know, 60% or around 60% of GDP comes from households. We kept asking, where is growth going to come from? Particularly if government is going to be reducing expenditure, but also there's not more spending or grants or allocations towards poorer households to support them to contribute to that money. And one of the problems with the I think it was Honorable Matapa who asked about small business and the small business grant. And I can't remember at which input I commented, but my view was that the 400 billion grant, so the guarantee for small business, shouldn't have been something that is a guarantee that goes through the private banking system. But it should actually be a direct injection of money into poorer communities and a lot of that to households. Because the best way to actually maintain and grow small businesses is to actually provide that money to the communities that are going to spend that money where the small businesses are situated. And in fact, if you start looking at the definitions of small business, the small businesses that could benefit from those kind of guarantees from the South African private banking system, and even from some of our DFIs, development finance institutions, are going to be the ones that are already fairly well developed, have staff to actually fill out forms and provide financials and projections and all those kinds of things. And the smaller businesses, the micro businesses and the informal sector businesses are going to be left out and actually not have that capacity. And basically, they'll be trying to run their businesses rather than putting in special applications for loans that benefit from guarantees. And so there's a process, I think, that we need to think about the economy not as this fixed part of the money and government's budget as the fixed part of the money, but as a dynamic and growing entity. And as we say in our presentation, you know, that government plays several and multiple roles in the economy, and it plays roles that the private sector and the markets won't do that, but in doing so, improve the situation in the market and for businesses. So the issue of shifting away from fiscal consolidation is linked to the fact that we've seen declining private sector investment, and now 2019 PMPBDS presentation, we put in a graph that shows that the levels of extension of credit to the private sector increased by about 10% of GDP in the few years after the global financial crisis, and it stayed at that level. But we see that the levels of private sector investment after the global financial crisis basically settled down to back to the early 2000s and didn't increase as it had in that period of digital and consumption and financial speculation that drove the increases in GDP in that period before the global financial crisis. And so South Africa now, we're seeing that banks, the private sector banks, have extended 10% of GDP more credit to the bowl of the private sector, including households, and the return in terms of gross fixed capital formation. Investment in fixed capital, not in trading paper and speculation in financial assets, and it requires now 10% more lending. And so we're actually not looking at the strain, the impact that has on households and also businesses. And thinking about what businesses are rather doing with the money they're borrowing than investing. So we've seen a long period in South Africa of low and even negative private sector fixed capital investment. And so the question then comes back to my first question, and the question we've been asking consistently is where is growth going to come from? And that growth is going to come from government, particularly government injecting money into poor households and providing the stability and security that is not going to lead to the kind of events that we saw before. And that brings me, I think, to Honourable Tabeti's question about the stopping the SRD grant and then getting that extra money from SARS to be able to afford it. And what we were saying at the time in the 2020 pre-MPBS, and we said it through the process of the meeting of the budget and afterwards, the vision of renewable and the appropriations bills, we've been saying that government should have looked at the possibilities of another wave. And even if it hadn't projected that increase, the state of South African households and the risks associated with the levels of inequality, but also the impact on households, required that injection of money to the economy, but also linked back to my previous point, that injection of money into the economy through households would have probably been the only growth that would be offsetting the negative impacts of COVID and the effects on businesses and the fact that the private businesses aren't investing. Almost all our views are shaped by carefully following not only trends in macroeconomics and South African economy, but also the debates and discussions within other countries and what is happening in other countries. I want to come to Honorable Sarupen's questions, both on fiscal policy and monetary policy. To start off with, he asks, PBO talks about fiscal policy without talking about the economy. And I think if you've listened to me carefully and what we've been saying over the last few years, is that government spending fiscal policy is an inherent and really important part of the economy. In fact, if you look at public sector expenditure from SOEs and government consumption, or what we call government consumption, but a lot of that is actually investing in communities, investing in health, investing in education. So, maybe we should stop talking about that as consumption and also stop drawing this artificial separation that the National Treasury keeps drawing between capital investment by government and consumption investment by government. But see the role of government spending in the economy as an integral and important part of economics, and particularly when you're having a downturn where the private sector isn't able to or won't respond through increasing investment and employment creation, but also when you have crises, whether it's a financial crisis like the global financial crisis, or whether it's one induced by the pandemic, and as we point to, the risks for the future increase global climate change risks that are we seeing huge effects around the world, people drowning in developed countries, in China, elsewhere, in the US, and even in New York City or New York State. We're seeing the impact of heat and drought, fires, etc. So in those kinds of situations, and we're seeing the response by the Biden administration as one that is very much about injecting huge amounts of money directly into households through over 3 trillion worth of grants, but also saying we've neglected infrastructure and we're going to put another 3 trillion dollars into infrastructure as a way to not only invest into the future, but to deal with the particular impacts of the pandemic and the crisis caused by it. Now, we've noticed that in Europe, there's also a big fiscal response, but not as big as the US. And the reason for that is that many European countries have automatic stabilizers. They have high levels of social spending, of free healthcare, high levels of unemployment and retraining of unemployed people within economies with fairly low levels of unemployment. But they're still injecting more money at the European Union and the European Central Bank, they are going to support the European countries in doing what they need to do. But if you look at, say, a rich country like Sweden, they have recognized that over time, that the way in which Sweden has integrated into the global economy has increased inequality. If you just look at what's happening on the private side, if the market will lift its own, inequality in Sweden will be increasing. So their response to that over time has been to increase taxes. And that has led to some sort of complaints within business and middle class and richer communities. But what they've done is the government has consciously tried to ensure equality and stability with that equality through redistribution through the tax system. And I think that for me is a really important issue. And we're seeing that even in countries like Germany, Sweden and others, there's been Norway, there's been pilot studies to look at introducing a basic income grant on top of all the other social benefits that they have and the high levels of services and education and health that they provide to their communities. So thinking about the economy and just thinking about the supply side of the economy, as you were talking about energy and those kinds of things, that isn't all of the economy. The whole economy is sort of the poor households, governments and businesses and the provision of utilities and network industries and stuff. And one of the problems with this approach that National Treasury has taken and what we say in our presentation is that we worry that the emphasis on fiscal consolidation forces National Treasury to only look at the supply side structural reforms. And we're not saying that there shouldn't be important supply side structural reforms. We're saying that it should be there, but it should be accompanied by serious attention to the state of households and the demand side of the economy. And that what we've been saying over the last few years in our presentations is that the success of the structural reforms and the effort the government is putting into ensuring the success of the structural reforms, the payback is going to be based on how the economy is growing and where that growth comes from. And on its own, without attention to the demand side, you're not going to get there. The other issue is just to say that you mentioned things like electricity and shade and energy, etc. as macro. Those are actually micro issues, and the structural reforms dealing with those kind of things or provoking trade are microeconomic issues. The macro issues are linked to how we broadly see the role of households, government and businesses in the economy, and I've spoken quite a bit about that, and I don't want to repeat myself. Just quickly, the PBO hasn't come out consistently and strongly against monetary policy. What we are seeing, and maybe what we have mentioned in the past, is that we're seeing an increased alignment between monetary and fiscal policy and an increased accommodation of fiscal policy by monetary policy across the world in response to not only COVID, but the downturns and the poor recovery from the global financial crisis in the period leading up to the COVID pandemic. What we're also seeing is the use of unconventional monetary policy. Well, it was called unconventional in 2009-10 when developed countries were responding to the crisis. Well, those are now becoming fairly conventional now almost 10 years later. And the use of quantitative easing, direct financing of government debt by central banks, central banks buying up private sector bonds, pushing interest rates, real interest rates below zero, those have become almost fairly conventional and it's been intensified with COVID. And it's totally changed the debates in the mainstream. It's kind of thing that people who weren't mainstream were pushing for a long period of time. And now through the policy actions that were necessary to deal with the global financial crisis and now COVID, we're actually seeing the whole debate about macro policy and the use of monetary policy, the independence of central banks and the relationship between fiscal and monetary policy all now being reconsidered. And there's several key major economic journals where there's been titles like Rethinking Macroeconomics over the last 3 or 4 years. I think maybe that is a good place for me to start. I think I was going to comment on tax, but I think Dr. Dankey says adequately touched on that, and if, maybe we should give members time to ask more questions, and I'll respond to this. Thank you very much for the patience, Honourable Chair.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thanks so much, Chairperson. We'll stop it then for further questions. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Dr. Mohammed.
Honourable members, a mouthful has been said. Is there anyone, based on what perhaps has just been, who would like to have one or two questions or comments on what has been shared with us by the good doctors from PBO? Honourable members?
Mlenzana.
Yes. Honourable Mlenzana.
Kaiso.
Honourable Kaiso. Another second bite. Okay. Let me allow Honourable Mlenzana.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's a generic question, Chairperson. Because look, when we are with Dr. Sanchez, one of the things is to for him to make us comfortable that yes, we are on track. And Dr. Sanchez, just your overall comment. Are you happy with this appropriation bill? Do you see us implementing it the right way? Is it taking us anywhere? Do you see changes after we would have adopted this bill as Parliament?
Thank you, Honorable Mlenzana. Honorable Kaiso.
Okay, Chair, thank you. You know, I was asking about the issue which was related to a restructuring that takes place in defense and police and the underspending and low spending. I missed that. Whether does it mean justification in the words of what was presented? That now because there is restructuring in those two departments, it might justify the low spending and the underspending. On there was also one issue that I raised about money bills and related matters, but I didn't get anything on that. Chair, I think the issue that has been raised on the HI funding and National Health Insurance funding and the issue on the state-owned entities and the tax wealth. It does say, I'm not sure whether Dr. Janchis or and the team means that we need to have discussion in future around those issues. So that we then as a committee accommodate them in due course so that we get an advantage of know how to engage on those issues with the information that will be provided. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, honorable members. Let me start by saying I would still like to hear more about what your take is about the changes which have taken place in the country as pronounced by the Minister of Finance, especially around company income tax, as far as our ultimate objective is concerned, which is to try and reduce unemployment, reduce poverty and inequality. I would like that goes to all the doctors. Dr. Olan, I think I hear you. You are raising a question of why now? In other words, a question of agency when we still have got these available funds, which you think that they have not have been used. I think my request would be, if you, again, you can just write and send back those questions to the committee,
because I would like us to further engage with them. Again, there is another question. It's a generic question. There's a lot of restructuring in the economy, especially around SOEs. And we've seen some of, and the main argument has been against some of these SOEs that have been coming to this committee, coming to Parliament, wanting to be bailed out. What do you think? I know perhaps it may be. Okay. What do you think privatization in this context, where you're having SOEs coming to government, come in and on many instances, what do you think privatization will do in terms of poverty and inequality? Perhaps picking up on Dr. Olandi's response to our question, am I also hearing you, perhaps it's a question which comes from that there's this 3.9 billion rand which is being put aside and to go to SASRA. Am I hearing your argument, perhaps saying that may not be an efficient and optimal way of distributing the scarce resources in the light of some of the SOEs that we know that are struggling? For instance, if you look at Denel and you're looking at the land bank, is the money that where we're seated at the moment maybe optimally used somewhere? Will that be a logical follow up to your argument? Then the next issue I want to raise, and again it may be related to what Orawikas was talking about. But what do you think? Do you think our problem in our economy is lack of money, or is lack of efficient use of the resources that we may be coming here time and again and appropriating money to try and solve the problems, the socioeconomic problems that we all know? Don't you think, and some of the things that, for instance, have been said as to what the macroeconomic policy should try to do. Are we not using the wrong instrument to try and solve some problems which are not money problems? I think you get my drift. Back to you, Dr. Chanchi from the team.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thanks so much for follow-up questions. Look, I think the main point I want to start with here is also around the issue of you know, having a conversation or a discussion around you know what's really a budget efficacy that we were aiming to achieve in sight, you know, because certainly there are a lot of competing interests that government, you know, want to address and so on. And there certainly, you know, in our discussion now, there's always going to be a trade-offs. But I think what I'm trying to emphasize here is that even if there's trade-offs, there has to be some understanding in terms of what are likely implications, you know, for the economy, for society, and the public finance in every choice or trade-offs that takes place, and take into account the context of our society. Pre, even post, even during the COVID-19, but I think having a long-term plan, you know, addressing some of these issues, you know, economic and social issues in this regard. The special, second special appropriations, you know, what are the views? Look, I think certainly certainly there are areas where which we even link it back to fiscal policy frameworks. As that saying that you probably would have had those, left without them being stopped in the social economic department there. And certainly this bill is really trying to recognize that some of the talk about the crisis in particular, probably it shows that it shouldn't have been stopped, see that it's been extended. And that is the one of the main issues. There are aspects of the bill that really, show that it's important to take these things. But I think also what we're trying to say is the context matters, and what has been some of the experiences in terms of spending patterns, experiences realizing the outcomes and so on, it matters most as well to take that into account. But I think what we're saying is that you need some of these expenditures in any case. But also look at the cycle as a whole, because as say we know that we're gonna have adjustment budget next month. And some of the aspects would have been taken into account in any case. But I think this would have been aligned a lot with the development around COVID-19 and economic progress in this regard that probably would have necessitated the special appropriations bills. You've seen so many businesses who have been affected by the events, and there was anticipation of bigger costs in that regard. And again, you should raise the question that I started with at the beginning of the main questions, that government has signed up for a national development plan which really emphasizes the importance of evidence-based policy and need for social economic impact assessments in some of these proposals. Of course, sometimes it's going to be, especially as an emergency spending, but I think there has to be some realization that there's a need to have a broader understanding of the potential implications of the policies. Yes, Chairperson, we have prepared a report. We will be finalizing it regarding the broadly thinking about the budget cut implications for some of these departments. And I think it's important to raise that we'll be submitting the report and just look at also specifically defense and some of the departments in the near future. As I said earlier, I think, Chairperson, the issue around the state-owned entities, I see there's a more critical question. I just have a frustration that when you look at the discussion around it, public domain, in media and so on, it's often seen in one side, which of course we have used that and a lot of requests for funding and so on. But I think what we have said in our report, which was linked to the presidential study as well, around really delineating the mandate of the state entities. It's also asked, remember in the literature, Chair, remember that the purpose of the state-owned entities around really dealing with some of the market failures, that the private sector, neither the government cannot address so certain services, and state-owned entities will come in and try to fill those. Hence, you have a development mandate, and you find that some of them, play into both development mandate and social economic mandate. And what we have seen also is that some of the state entities certainly do claim a developmental mandate when they're doing poorly, and some do claim a commercial mandate when they're doing well. And I think this really, for me, requires a very empirical work in that regard, because when you talk about bailout, is it a bailout for commercial mandate or is it a bailout for developmental mandate? Because it's a developmental mandate, certainly. It's something that you have to do as government, because it's about filling the market failure, which would have been the role that government wants to play in that regard. So I think Chair would really love to come back on this one in terms of prioritization and the implications of. But I think what we have to recognize, there has certainly been failures in governance, many state entities, and also in the report, and the other report has acknowledged that there's been wastages and so forth. So that's why I feel like maybe and more of a quick empirical work will also provide more reliable and credible analysis in this regard. So we'll ask that from the committee. the money bills, I think Honorable Kaiso might be referring to, just correct me, to Public Finance Management Act, in a sense. I missed that question, so I'll come back to it. Get clarity. Are you referring to Public Financial Management Act, Honorable Kaiso? Just to be sure, because I thought that you're referring to, insofar as being, make it difficult for departments or for government to roll over the funds that were used up. And so is that how I'm picking up properly, Honorable Kaiso?
Actually referring to Money Bills and Related Matters Act and the way you appropriate money. Yeah.
Okay, all right. I think the question around Money Bills Act, it really recognizes the way our democracy has been set up, because it comes from the Constitution itself, because it does say that the Minister of Finance can propose money bills, you know, and that's what the Constitution says. The Constitution says only Minister of Finance can propose money bills. The Constitution of the country can propose money bills, but the role of the legislature would be more of amending those bills or making proposals to, in terms of the areas where it requires more funding than others. But I think, Honorable Kaiso and Chairperson, Honorable Members, I think the main question, again, which I really pose it here, is that, you know, then are we saying, are we getting, as a Members of Parliament, are you getting more useful information then to really assess whether the money bills is actually providing more information? And then there's strongly evidence that shows that there are useful information that comes from government, but also that shows that maybe that information, some of the information, is not really relevant in the sense of how you look at how the Constitution, in my view, and the stage of Parliament. You know, I think, in a way, it looks at, when you, as a member of Parliament, come here, you need to address the concerns of the constituency, inequalities, citizenship delivery, and so many other aspects that comes with the democratic state and where the role of government is coming. And I don't know if there's a need more information which allows members of Parliament to see whether this budget in itself has actually improved the has led to better political outcomes, let me put it that way. Or need more information that shows it, because most of the information that comes really is about the output. It's about how much, you know, has been built, how much has employees appointed and so on. I mean, I'm being very simplistic here, but I'm just saying that it's largely, look at the reporting itself, and reporting, okay, particularly the quota report, expenditure report, it's more about what much has been spent and less so much how much has that been useful in dealing with the major socioeconomic challenges we have as a society and the economic development that we got, or how much has those actually improved on development and outcomes. So there is, it's been silent in that sense, in a way, and I think there's space for me, if there's any need to really exercise from the legislative perspective, would be more value added for oversight. Say, look, we need information that help us know as a parliament, because this information is helping us. Yes, we're able to pick up some of these issues, but I think as constituents, when we go back to constituents and members of parliament, they want to hear from us, you know, how are we going out of poverty, and yet this budget is spent, and so on. So I think that's our comment, and leave it there. Chairperson, members, I think I've touched on the question around CIT. I don't think I got it quite clear. Maybe I missed it, Chairperson. Corporate income tax. I don't know if I understood the question again, Chair. Do you mind repeating that one again, Chairperson? The corporate income tax point.
Well, okay. Okay, let me paint you the picture. The picture that we are having is a fiscus which is constrained. Companies generally not bringing in more tax, individuals not bringing in more tax. But on the other side, you have got many needs which the government must look into. And that in that environment, we decreased company income tax. At face value, it looks like a contradiction of some sort, right? There might have been a hypothesis for that. So I want to get your scientific analysis of that. what are we going to, or what do we hope to achieve on that? And again, you know, the argument that comes up is that when it comes to company income tax, we are far above when compared to other countries. So I just wanted to, obviously, tax is an instrument towards a particular end. Né? It's a means to an end, but which is that end which we hope to get? What is the hypothesis, for instance, if you know it? I'm sure you get what I mean.
Thanks. I think I get it. But I think National Treasurer will better be able to answer the question. Yeah. But I think what I try to say, Chair, is that my understanding in terms of the proposals that were put out by government last year and some of the analysis that we've done and so forth, I think the point I said earlier was that the issues around tax policy, it does for me matter in terms of looking at it in a contextual way, like many other policies in any case. Because what we have said last year to the Select Finance Committee during the discussion on the emergency bill, firstly, we said, look, there probably are opportunities for a solidarity tax in some of the areas. You find that you know, some business really did not earn the income they just got it due to COVID-19, and maybe you need to, maybe like it was done internationally, where some of the areas were considered whether you need to have sort of a one measure which you increase tax for that particular time. But of course, it's a small discussion issue. But I think, which didn't go far, but I think the point that, you know, going back to fiscal, the tax proposals that came in last year, it sounded, I remember where I could receive a colleague from there, it's not really about reducing corporate tax rate. because that would not be in line with the global context as far as the literature is concerned as well. As far as the context of the developing countries is concerned, as far as the proposals that have been coming up this globally is concerned, it's not be in line with that reducing corporate tax, corporate income tax. And there isn't any evidence also that support the view that we've reached the maximum level at which we can impose taxes in society or in the economy. But of course, it matters to really try to contextualize in the sense of how is that tax being recycled back to the economy? Because the bigger issue here is being to recycle back to create those economic activities back in the system. The understanding of the proposals around aligning, reducing tax expenditure. Because as I said earlier, on the conversation around corporate tax, it's often muddied from a user word. Because when we look at South Africa and many other countries, we've got some of the highest tax expenditure for corporate tax in particular, where in a sense that hadn't we had those, even if the tax rate, let's give an example, if the tax rate, let's say tax rate is 28% of the CIT, corporate tax rate CIT, there's so many expenditure when you look at the budget document appendix C, I think, which shows that there's so many give away as well in the system of rate business in terms of the expenditure, you know, where when you look at, I think the Judge Dennis Tax Commission had actually commented on that a couple of years ago, that actually some of the effective tax rate will really, the effective tax rate will actually come quite below 14-15%, just way below that if we look at that. And in a way, it might look at 28%, but in reality, it's actually less than 15% of the actual tax paid by businesses. And I think the understanding, as I got from the colleagues in Treasury, they're trying to rather take away those expenditures or some of those expenditures and, in a way, leverage back to the rate, in an actual rate. I don't know if that makes sense. No, not necessarily taking away. So it's going to be budget neutral, really, as opposed to, reducing the revenue itself. And I think it's something that came up. But I think that there's a broader conversation globally, which I think also we should have, as government, say there has already been a leakage in the system of the multinational enterprises, leaking up and so on. And there has been a global concerted effort to deal with the taxes, then the loss of tax bases particularly from small countries to big countries. But I think the other question, Chair, around tax, corporate income tax, around the digitalization of economic activities, we've seen this rapidly going a lot over the past year or 18 months or so, where the tax system globally, even ourselves, has not yet up really to raise enough generated revenue within the digitalized economic activities. And I think that's a reform that even the Ministry of Technology last year, the commission study which recommended for government to the president to actually that there has to be some concern for to raise more revenue from the digitalized economic activities, which is more innovative required by a sector increase the tax base within the corporate income tax. But I think we'll have this more conversation with the finance committees, but I think we can have more conversation around this in this regard, Chair. I'll give there were other 2 points, I think. I'll give Dr. Olandi and Dr. Mohamed to come in those points. But any other questions, Chair, we'll be happy if we leave them out to also put them in writing. And maybe the chairman and the team will write us specific questions and put them in writing for any further conversations. But we will definitely respond to the questions. Thank you so much, Chair. Dr. Olandi, thank you so much.
Thank you, Dumisani. Yes, I don't think it's a loophole in the Money Bills Act, but what I do think in terms of the under and over expenditure and what do we consider to be useful to implement or change our processes in terms of determining budgets, you know that we don't really, as in our committees, we don't really consider the BRR reports. And those reports are supposed to provide us with a holistic picture of what is really going on in a department. We need to know in terms of, because they look at the expenditure trends, they look at the budget analysis, they look at performance information, and they also look at the annual financial statements and the AG reports. So that gives us a holistic picture of really what is going on in a department. And for the budget office, it's not possible to do BRR reports or a total budget analysis per department during the budget process. In our report that Dumisani also now referred to is that we basically did a mini budget analysis taking into consideration the current trends, expenditure trends, the current budget, how the budget changed in terms of revised estimates, how the budget changed in terms of previous year's estimates. And we looked at personnel costs, how they changed the organizational structures and how they changed their personnel, how many staff they have above the approved organizational structures. And we also looked at performance information, specifically the key performance information that's linked to the budget. So we tried to do that. And I think perhaps we might try to bring in an additional step in our process before we approve the budget, considering the BRR reports. The BRR reports can also basically provide us some more information, such as the information that will now be provided by the reviews, and perhaps also provide us with additional information in terms of zero-based budgeting or identify those programs that is basically required to go back and do zero-based budgeting. So it's not a loophole. Perhaps we just need to use the tools that are available more effectively when we consider the budget. Honourable Buthelezi, the SASRA issue, the perception that the information that we got from the Treasury actually creates the perception that it's a bailout. And when we have our discussions with SASRA itself, we might get more information in terms of what is really required. And you also mentioned other institutions that are basically more in need, and how do we make that trade-off? Do we now bail out SASRA immediately now with urgent allocation, or do we also consider other requests that might come up with the adjustments appropriations in terms of some of our other entities that are also in need of support? That's basically what I want to say in terms of the two questions.
Okay, thanks so much, Chairperson. Siraj, can I come in? Thanks.
Thank you, I don't think you or the Minister touched on the question on privatization, and I thought I'd start with that. I believe that, we shouldn't take an ideological stance on privatization. We should take it on a case-by-case basis and look at, what those SOEs are providing within the economy, and whether those SOEs are providing services and to society and particularly that support development that deal with basic needs and those things. So one could maybe arguably say, SAA, we could be comfortable about privatizing SAA, but do we want to privatize water provision in South Africa? We've seen, I think, through the late 80s, right through to the 2000s, protests and privatization and then re-nationalization of water facilities in some developing countries through that period. They also, if one looks at the development in some of the in South Asia, but also some of the East Asian countries, certain important inputs like steel, concrete, microchips, etc., have seen a large role played by the state. In countries like India, directly through state-owned steel corporation. In South Africa, in fact, we also had ISCO, and that was seen as important for supporting industrialization and development. I don't think it was done for necessarily ideological reasons to say that the state should be more involved in funding, but to say, how do we actually facilitate our industrial development and industrial transformation goals, and also what role does it play in the development in terms of dealing with improving the quality of lives and productivity of our citizens. So I think for me, that we need to look at that on a case-by-case basis. And I think I just want to remind Honorable Chair of comments I made about ISCOM when we were discussing the ISCOM debt and finances I can't remember how long ago. Everything before COVID seems really long ago. But one of my comments was that, we don't look at ISCOM from the long term. And I said that I'd been involved in things like the National Electrification Forum in 1993. There was a failure of government to actually invest adequately early on in expanding generation. A lot of the household electrification program was put on ESCOM, and only later did the government inject money into ESCOM. And so even if there was a lot of corruption, waste, expenditure, et cetera, once, Maduka and Kofi were put in place, and also, privatization or outsourcing of coal supplies and provisions and state related to that, what I think government is actually now paying for money that they should have been injecting into ESCOM from the late 90s, through New Gold, through actually improving services and also paying more for the electrification program. I mean, one of our successes as a country has been the national electrification program. So think about what we do with ESCOM, and if it comes for another bailout, I see it made a 90 million loss on paper. We have to think about it from those perspectives, and whether, you know, privatization is the way to do that. But also, I think for things like water. So I won't get too much more into that. I think that's an ongoing discussion we should have, and I think it should be done on a case-by-case basis. In terms of the tax issues, one of my contributions early on in the PBO, I think that even before this parliament, before the election, was that I have trouble with thinking about, especially when it comes to corporate tax, you know, we treat all economic players the same. And what we've seen over the last few years is that the bigger and bigger role being played by services, particularly financial services, but also retailing and related services. And we need corporate tax. And I think for me, the reduction in corporate tax in the budget, that sort of 1% was more symbolic because we were expecting much lower incomes from corporates, in 2020, but also this year, as companies are rebuilding and probably reinvesting to make up for losses. So we actually, even if we're reducing the tax rates, they wouldn't actually have benefited that much from the reduction this year. And so I think for me, I saw it more as a symbolic gesture rather than a real gesture towards supporting investment and growth and getting more business activity. There was one more question that I wanted to come to. In terms of taxation in South Africa and what we've experienced with COVID and the events of July, is that the need for thinking about solidarity by particularly the better off in society, those with good paying, stable jobs, but also the top 1%, is to think about instability and inequality the way we've been thinking about COVID. Is that
Dr. Mohammed, please switch off your video so that you can finish your point.
Sir, I just finished the point. Yeah, I was just saying switch off the mic and the video and finish the point.
I'm just going to finish it quickly. Is that the impacts of inequality can be talked about just like we talked about COVID, that it affects everybody, and at some point it can be really damaging. And so we should think about willingness to sacrifice more in terms of taxes to support less inequality. That's kind of you spoke about solidarity tax, and I think that should become part of our discourse and debate in South Africa about thinking more about tax in that way rather than tax as a burden and that too few people pay tax. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Dr. Command. Chair, just a last point. I think I missed I wanted to comment on the point about the structuring on the defense. I think the report that the committee has requested us to do will touch on defense and will comment on the structuring on the police and defense. I had forgot that point. Yeah, I think we'll, in that report we'll try to get that point as well coming in. Chairperson, thank you so much. I think just the last, there's a very strong question from Honorable Mlenza that what is our view on the appropriation point, the second appropriation? I think we've indicated the other aspects of the appropriation that requires support from the parliament, which, you know, shows that should have been should not have been taken away in the case. But I think that for us, really, Chair, it's around the broader question of the fiscal policy, you know, objectives, and also looking at the risks that we've seen, some of them being realized. And of course, we're building up towards medium term and also long term planning around fiscal policy stance and bringing all these players into the space. Thank you so much, Chairperson, and all our members. And with that, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Sanchez Olani and Dr. Mohammed. Dr. Sanchez, there's something on Kolotayon, right? So come back.
Okay, Chairperson. I must remember that. I'll ask. Is it the report? I know the report. We drew the report of the budget cuts. Is it? I referring to that one. That's the one I was referring to. One of guys that we will look at the structuring as he mentioned them. You know, to take them into account. Is
there
another one?
To the
Peter,
it's okay.
You know, Dr. Jain is very
uh-huh.
He has got his own way of, you know, going through
Tribula.
Yeah.
I don't know about that.
okay.
Thanks,
PBO. Thank you very much. That was and obviously, as you said, that when we discuss these things, they can't be just in a vacuum. There's a broader macroeconomic environment and socioeconomic conditions within which we are discussing the second appropriation. Special appropriation team. Thank you. As you know that we are very transparent, you can remain in the meeting, but let's go to agenda item number five, honorable members.
Thank you so much, members. Thank you so much. We'll move to other meeting. Thank you so much for the opportunity. Thank you. Okay. We'll come forward with other questions, follow-up questions. Thank you so much.
Good. Honorable members. We're on agenda item number five. We're looking at the minutes of the 31st of August 2021, minutes which were sent to us. Take it to have read them. Do I have a mover and a seconder?
Chairperson Mlenzana, yeah?
Yes, Mlenzana.
Just one thing which I've picked up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure of the page, but it's bullet. Five, line six. I'm trying to quickly get there now.
Yeah.
But the last sentence or the last word in that sentence in line six is saying blah 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 blah. It talks about the jail time. Do you see it, Shabazi? Should it be jail time or jail term? You say that, Chairperson?
It's term.
So we need to correct it then.
Yeah.
Thanks, Chairperson. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I move for the adoption of the minutes with amendments.
Seconder? Honourable members, do I have a seconder? Honourable members, Honourable Mlenzana has moved. For the adoption, I'm waiting for the seconder. I think all members are struggling. Not to adopt the minutes for now. Can we go to the next agenda item? Darren, you want to talk about the any announcements?
Chairperson, yes, we do have announcements. Today, the NA programming committee met, and then substantial changes were made to the program, to Parliament's program, in light of the recent constitutional court judgment. This resulted in us having to change our program. For this week, the program remains the same. We are still meeting tomorrow, even though there is a plenary scheduled to start at 10 o'clock tomorrow. We received special permission to meet because we are dealing with a bill. Furthermore, we've also applied to the Office of the House Chairperson and to the Chief Whip for us to be granted permission to meet during constituency period in order to finalize the bill. So we are still awaiting the response from those respective offices, Chairperson. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. Any question based on what Darren has just reported? Yes, sir.
No question yet, Chairperson, except for yourself as the management committee.
Yes.
If you can advise us, you know, in time, because I read the announcement from the Office of the Chief Whip in the morning. It suggests that ours as appropriation has to go through. So I think Uterin and yourselves should work on it and advise ourselves accordingly. And we see, lest we get ambushed. But I think one way or the other, we had to deal with the appropriations, the second appropriations bill. But as I'm saying, needless also to say, let's not rearrange our program. I'm thinking aloud, Chairperson.
No, you are spot on, Honorable Mlenzane. I think that's why Darren is saying that for now, for this week, we have been given permission to continue our program as it were. But again, we have communicated with the Honorable Frolic talking about this is an urgent deal. So from where we are seated is the bill that must be finalized. But we have communicated with the management in Parliament to make sure that we get clarity as to how we proceed. So yes, we are spot on. You are muted, Honorable Mlenzane.
Sorry. I was saying Honorable Kaiso is back now. So we can now get the second.
Okay, that's fine. So we are spot on, we're in agreement as far as this is concerned. Or members, I saw that you were struggling, some of you were muted. I put the minutes for adoption, and Honorable Mlenzane moved with the amendment. Just repeat the amendment that you spoke about, Honorable Mlenzane.
Oh yes, thanks, Chair. The amendment was bullet 5, line 6, the last sentence there. And the amendment was we changed the word time, jail time, to jail term.
Yeah.
And then I moved with the amendment.
Second,
A second, Chair.
I second, Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Honorable. Honorable Kaiso's seconds. Thank you. Honorable members, I know you were cutting. Did you hear the announcement by Darren?
No,
I missed it too as well.
Honorable members, I'll ask Darren just to report the announcement, to repeat the announcement.
Chairperson, yes, the recent Constitutional Court judgment on the local government elections has resulted in the NA programming committee making changes to the program for this term. Therefore, our committee will obviously be affected by those changes, and therefore we need to make amendments. However, for this week, we are still going ahead with our meeting tomorrow, the meeting with Sazria, even though there is a plenary scheduled to start in the morning. And then furthermore, we have written to the offices of the House Chairperson and the Chief Whip to grant the committee permission to meet during the constituency period in order to finalize the bill. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Darren. Any clarification around members? Clear. Okay. Thank you. All members, that takes us to the end of today's meeting. But I think there were points which were raised, which needs our consideration. For instance, about the agency of some of the items in the special appropriation and the second appropriation bill. And I'm saying that in the light of other pressures in the fiscal. So let's just think about that. And I'd ask them, Dr. Oland to write back about these things that she was raising, because I think it's important that we engage them with a national treasure. Okay. Agreed. Honorable members.
Agreed, Chairperson.
Yeah.
Okay. Agreed, Chairperson.
Thank you. Thank you. That takes us to the end of the meeting. The meeting stands adjourned, and thank you very much.